This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It has been another busy week. The impeachment inquiry continued. The acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told reporters the U.S. withheld military aid to force Ukraine to investigate corruption. Senator Elizabeth Warren came under fire from fellow Democratic presidential candidates. And auto workers reached a tentative deal with General Motors after nearly 5 weeks of being on strike. Plenty to discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us in studio to discuss the week's top stories is Eugene Scott, a political reporter with The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Yamiche Alcindor, a White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Welcome, Yamiche.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Mason, White House correspondent with Reuters. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
It would be great to get your questions and thoughts on this week's news. It's been a super busy week. Our goal is to try to break down everything that's been going on. Now is a good time to ask whatever those quote-unquote dumb questions are that you've had, as the stories of the week have been moving super fast. So whatever's on your mind, go ahead and ask. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. This was another one of those weeks where we can't really finish building the roundup until like Thursday evening at 4:53.
Yeah.
Because yesterday, Mick Mulvaney, who is the acting White House Chief of Staff, told reporters that the U.S. withheld military aid to force Ukraine to investigate corruption. This goes back to that phone call over the summer between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Here is what Mick Mulvaney said.
Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
That's why we held up the money. Those were the words of Mick Mulvaney. He later tried to walk that back the same day. But Yamiche, let me start with that. You and Jeff were both at that press conference. Explain, Yamiche, what precisely Mulvaney was talking about and why that matters.
He was talking about the call. He was talking about how military aid was withheld from Ukraine. And it was a pretty stunning thing that happened in that briefing room. I think all reporters in there were thinking, wait, did Mick Mulvaney just say there was a quid pro quo? Because it was very clear what he was saying. And he was saying, at the end of the day, this is about political influence and elections have consequences. And people should just, quote, get over it. So only a couple hours later, when people were really parsing through what he said, I think was Mick Mulvaney now having to realize, wait, I need to walk this back. And there were so many people that were really backing up from that. People within the Trump administration. I was talking to a senior DOJ official who said the DOJ does not know what Mick Mulvaney's talking about. We have no information about money being withheld because of a DOJ investigation. So what you saw was really Mick Mulvaney on an island on his own. Even the president's personal attorneys, Jay Sekulow, and I was texting with Rudy Giuliani. Both of them said, nope, we don't know what Mick Mulvaney's talking about. Rudy Giuliani was kind of saying, well, I don't know if that's exactly what he was saying, that this was a quid pro quo. But when that statement came out, in some ways, it was also as surprising as the original statement, because all of it seemed as though Mick Mulvaney was not on the same page as President Trump.
Jeff Mason, this all, of course, goes back to the House impeachment inquiry. Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said that this just made a very, very bad situation much, much worse. We should be clear, you know, in legal circles, bribery requires proving a quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. Mick Mulvaney said there was a quid pro quo. So I don't know how this does not make things worse.
Well, I think it certainly did for the White House. And I spoke to a few former administration officials yesterday, one of whom said to me, look, if your goal was to get the impeachment vote moved up faster, then that's probably what was achieved yesterday at that press conference with Mick Mulvaney. I mean, he, as Yamiche rightly said, basically undermined every argument that President Trump has been making and that his advisors have been making about the origins of this impeachment probe, which was that there was no asking of a favor in return for another favor. For context, at that same sort of in that same breath right before that, Mulvaney was also saying the president was upset that other European nations had not provided enough lethal aid to Ukraine. But then in the follow-up, he confirmed that it was that aspect and the aspect of political corruption, particularly the piece about this DNC server being in Ukraine, which has been debunked, were the reasons for withholding the aid.
There was also, Jeff and Eugene, I want to talk more broadly about the other testimony this week from administration officials. But Jeff, there was also a tone to that news conference. And Yamiche, I don't know if you felt this as well, but for me, just watching from my office, there was a real pugnaciousness from Mick Mulvaney. There was kind of this braggadocious, like, yeah, we did it. The law allows it. It's the way it is. You know, sorry you guys don't like what we do, but this is the way it's done. So tough. You can keep asking me the same question over and over, however many times you want to, but the president has the power to do this. Suck it up. That basically felt like the tone of Mick Mulvaney's comments.
100%. I mean, Mick Mulvaney is a pretty confident guy either way. I mean, he hasn't briefed the press in a long time, but I recall the other times. Well, he's been in there. I think he was in the briefing room once as OMB director.
Right, yes. Yeah.
And also showed quite a bit of confidence in what he had to say. But it was striking, number one, that he yesterday, again, undermined the argument. And also, I mean, the fact that he stayed, and we were talking about this earlier, and took questions, A, no doubt meant he had the blessing of the president to give a briefing, and B, showed that he either wasn't entirely ready for the question about Ukraine aid or hadn't clearly had that answer vetted in advance.
I think
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it'll be really interesting how often in the future he has the blessing of the president, because some of the reporting that has come out said that Trump is really upset with how he handled yesterday in terms of undermining the argument, pushing back on having to push back on what he said earlier, making it look as much more complicated than the White House currently wants it, and putting Trump in a difficult position going forward regarding with the impeachment.
What you saw in Mick Mulvaney was someone who was trying to get out ahead of criticism. And as a result, he was looking like someone who wanted to at least seem confident. But he said even before this, because before he was talking about Ukraine, he was talking about the G7. He was saying, well, I was kind of surprised by the president's decision there. But by the way, we can do this. So then that same tone carried over to Ukraine when he said, hey, by the way, you know, this is how things are done. This is what people elected us to do. But that statement afterwards, 6 hours about afterwards, when he said, actually, my words are being misconstrued, it felt like he pushed up against the line. And then when he realized he crossed that line, he was trying to really, really tiptoe back over the line.
Let's talk a bit about some of the testimony that was going on behind closed doors from former and current Trump administration officials. Eugene, let's start with EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland. He was one of the people who was involved in this infamous text message exchange where he sent that two-word text, call me, in response to some concerns about the nature of President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Did we learn anything from him? I know it was behind closed doors, but what can we divine from his testimony?
Well, it appeared from his testimony he's one of the people who seemed to be upset or concerned, at the very least, with how Rudy Giuliani was interacting with people in the Ukraine and what amount of influence that could have in the future election. But he also expressed that he was under the impression that perhaps he was working with under the direction and with the permission of the president, which I think raised some red flags for many people who are trying to move forward with the impeachment inquiry, because this is what they have found to be problematic, or at least believe will be proven to be problematic, but that Giuliani, that Trump, that other officials have said has not been the case.
There was also Jeff Fiona Hill, who's President Trump's former advisor on Russia and Europe. What did we learn from her testimony?
Well, what we learned primarily from Fiona Hill was how upset John Bolton was about this entire issue. John Bolton used to be the national security advisor and apparently directed her to pass on what was going on with Ukraine to the NSC lawyers. And Bolton apparently said that, referred to Giuliani as a hand grenade, said he wasn't part of this drug deal that was being cooked up. And I think also worth noting, just to go back to Sondland, though his testimony, Eugene's 100% right about what he testified, there was some maybe question marks about whether or not he was testifying in that way to cover his own back, as it were, because a lot of the reporting ahead of that testimony has said that Sondland was one of a trio of people, including Giuliani, who had essentially had this shadow diplomacy in Ukraine. That's not how he portrayed it, apparently, in his testimony, but that is how others have portrayed it themselves.
Yamiche, there was also testimony from George P. Kent, who was a senior Ukraine expert. What did we learn from him? Was it kind of a piece with what the other diplomats, present and former, testified?
Based on the reporting that's been coming out, he said that he was trying to warn the Obama administration in 2015 about Hunter, and basically saying that he wanted to look into that and that a Biden staffer basically slapped that idea down.
About Hunter Biden and
about
his business
Hunter
dealings.
Biden. And the thing that's interesting, though, if we go back to those other two testimonies, Gordon Sondland came to the Hill, and he's someone who has donated a lot of money to President Trump's campaign, but he said he was disappointed in the president's decision-making when it came to Ukraine. And he said he was also very concerned about Rudy Giuliani and this sort of shadow campaign. That's a big deal for President Trump, because this is someone that he's political. This is a political appointee having space between himself and President Trump, really trying to distance himself. And that tells you kind of where this is going. You've had official after official basically come there and say, look, here's what I know, and here's what I think Rudy Giuliani was doing. And by the way, I was a little disturbed by what Rudy Giuliani was saying. That's a theme that's emerging in these impeachment inquiry hearings, and that's problematic for the president.
Yeah, the Times and the Washington Post have reported that Rudy Giuliani pushed the president to deport a Turkish cleric, Fethullah Gulen, from the United States. There's concern that Rudy Giuliani was basically acting as a foreign agent, but is not registered as one. That gets to some of the comments that y'all have been sending us, including from Nancy, who tweeted, did Rudy Giuliani ever have to go through a federal background check to be Trump's personal attorney or to act for this administration? We got a lot of comments like the email from Brad in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Brad writes, when is enough enough? This president is a disaster. Republicans need to see it for what it is, do what's right and best for the country, and move on. Mike tweeted, could it be specifically articulated what illegal act the president is being accused of by Democrats to cause impeachment? That answer might have evolved in the last 28 hours, maybe? We'll try to answer Mike's question in a minute when we continue with Eugene Scott of The Washington Post, Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour, and Jeff Mason of Reuters, and we'll get to more of your questions and comments as well. I'm Joshua Johnson on a very busy Friday. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Capitol Hill is grieving the death of Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings. The lawmaker who represented his beloved Baltimore died yesterday at age 68. No word on the exact cause of death. His office attributes it to long-standing health challenges. Cummings was born into a family of Baptist preachers. He won his first congressional term in 1996. Cummings served on the Congressional Black Caucus and was chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee when he died. His chairmanship made him a prominent voice in the investigations of the Trump administration. It's the Friday News Roundup with Eugene Scott of The Washington Post, Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get back to Nancy's tweet. Nancy asked, did Rudy Giuliani ever have to go through a federal background check to be Trump's personal attorney or to act for this administration? Eugene, I think that's kind of the core of some of the discussion this week in terms of what Rudy Giuliani has been doing in the name of the administration, including pushing the president to deport this Turkish cleric, Fethullah Gulen, from the U.S. Where does that stand in terms of a larger concern? It seems like this week there have been a lot of larger concerns, and this is one of those that's just been kind of a running thread for the last few weeks.
Well, that is part of the concern. As his personal attorney, it wasn't immediately clear what his responsibilities would entail, but people definitely didn't expect them to entail shaping Ukraine foreign policy, and that's been part of the problem. Initially, the thought was that this was his responsibilities with the president may have been related to the whole Stormy Daniels situation, but for it to spill over in this area and the elections in 2020 is what many Democrats and even some Republicans have said. This is why people were calling him a hand grenade and expressing concern about him very early.
Well, and that's the issue I think Nancy just gets at, is that, you know, you don't have to go through a background check to be someone's personal attorney, but he's kind of slid from being the president's personal attorney to having roles in policy that don't necessarily involve him being vetted through some kind of larger system.
Right.
Specifically foreign policy and you know, acting in a way that governments may not be able to distinguish between somebody who is a diplomat who works on behalf of the United States government and someone who is representing President Trump in either a personal or a more professional capacity.
And I put the question to Mick Mulvaney yesterday in that marathon press briefing that felt really, really long anyways, even though it was 30 minutes. And what he I asked him, well, why should Rudy Giuliani's work be, quote, intertwined, as he's told me, with the president's personal business and his personal political leanings and U.S. national foreign policy? And Mick Mulvaney, after I pressed him a bit, said, I think all of what Rudy Giuliani is doing is appropriate. So what you have is the chief of staff, the acting chief of staff to the president of the United States saying, it's okay, I'm completely okay with Rudy Giuliani going to Ukraine and not being someone who is part of the State Department, not being a part of the official government, but also doing official government business.
Mike asked a good question. Let's go back to that one. He asked, could it be specifically articulated what illegal act the president is being accused of by Democrats to cause impeachment? I think the answer is essentially bribery, but that's partly what the inquiry is about. And I also think that's partly why some Republicans are denouncing it as a fishing expedition, because they're kind of casting a wide net. But Eugene, I think bribery is kind of what they're zeroing in on, but who knows?
So in part, it depends on which Democratic lawmaker you're speaking to. So when you talk about high crimes and misdemeanors, I mean, there's some room in there for quite a bit of in terms of determining what it's inappropriate. When I was interviewing Representative Al Green, he was saying that the president just being inappropriately racist and discriminatory and just makes him unfit for office.
He actually brought a House resolution to impeach the president some time ago, didn't he?
In August, I believe, based on that. But most recently, there's been concern that the issue with quid pro quo is bribery, is keeping funds away from a foreign government to do your bidding in the way that specifically when it comes to interfering in an election. And there were people in Congress, Democrats, who said that actually should be criminal.
Dan emailed, you're not understanding the distinction Mulvaney was making. The point was there was quid pro quo for military aid for an open investigation regarding the DNC server versus a new or non-official investigation of Hunter Biden. Jeff Mason, is there a distinction there? Does that make sense?
Well, that's something that we were trying to get some clarity on yesterday, and he was sort of making a distinction there yesterday. He said that the president had raised the issue of this DNC server. That is a backward-looking piece that was looking at 2016, whereas talking about Biden would be considered forward-looking, going into 2020. I'm not sure if that kind of distinction is going to have a whole lot of weight with investigators or with lawmakers in Congress, but it is, I mean, the writer is right to say that that was one that was raised.
Mystic Warrior tweeted, how do we know the testimony from closed-door hearings? Are statements being released? If the information comes from leaks, why should we trust either side's partisans? Yamiche?
Journalists do the work. I think that if you read your newspapers, if you watch your televisions, people like me and Jeff and Eugene are calling people constantly to get information, and we're getting the information. So we know about Gordon Sondland because there was literally a opening statement released and it hit the internet and there were multiple people who had it. I know I've been talking to all sorts of people on the Hill about all the other testimonies, like Michael McKinley, who came forward to say that career diplomats were having their careers upended, he thought, for political reasons. So that's how you can trust the information. You can trust that journalists, when we got in this field, we wanted to talk to people and tell the truth, and that's what you're getting.
We should also just back up a little bit, because I had this conversation with someone very, very recently, yesterday as a matter of fact, that a fair amount of the reporting that has come out since the beginning of the Trump administration has been corroborated either by the Mueller report or by federal prosecutors. Michael Flynn got pinched after a report came out in the New York Times. The Mueller investigation began after President Trump was interviewed by Lester Holt of NBC News. Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yes.
There are plenty of things that have been reported by journalists and then corroborated by federal investigators. Not everything, not perfectly, but the batting average is closer to 1,000 than to zero.
It's like the first draft of history, maybe.
It is. And then, oddly enough, federal prosecutors are writing the second draft. What's the next step we can expect in the impeachment inquiry? What should we be keeping an eye out for?
I think more testimony. I think there are going to be all sorts of people hauled into Congress. I would possibly imagine maybe Mick Mulvaney being called in to testify because he obviously had that explosive statement yesterday and then the walk back. So I think we're going to see a number of people. Bill Taylor is supposed to be coming to the Hill next week. He is the person who sent that text message that was provided by Kurt Volker, who was the former envoy to Ukraine. Bill Taylor is a career official working in the State Department. And that person, Bill Taylor, said that he thought it was crazy to hold up military aid for political reasons. So I think we're going to see a lot of people continuing to come forward.
One more thing before we move on and talk about foreign affairs, Eugene. We learned yesterday afternoon that Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who's the former governor of Texas, has announced that he would resign as Energy Secretary. He had recently been in the Wall Street Journal and gave an interview to the Journal where he talked about kind of his role in getting Rudy Giuliani to talk to Ukraine. Rick Perry is one of the very, very first people and the longest serving people in this administration who's kind of been there from start to finish.
Indeed.
From start to now, I should say.
Well, he was one of the people that you remember the president was having trouble getting some credibility from establishment figures. And he certainly had that and was able to take some votes, move them towards Trump's way within his native Texas, away from Ted Cruz. And so this is definitely someone who I think people could point to as help paving the way for Trump. But and a lot of the administration had been relatively quiet. We hadn't heard a lot from him, despite him being really vocal early on. And this time right now, him leaving and moving towards leaving, there's new eyes on him because of his involvement with Giuliani and what role he could have played in Ukraine.
Let's move on and talk about national security matters. I've had very little caffeine today, and yet I feel like I am awake and like this is moving at 900 miles. And I'm the only person in this room who feels like their brain is just kind of like running in top gear right now.
Absolutely not. I like now come home and I sit down in my sofa and I just like sit sometimes just in quiet, like in my 90-year-old grandmother. And I'm like, oh, now I know why people just sit.
Why they just need to be quiet and just go.
I like it.
Yes.
I like it.
Good. That makes me feel much better.
Words to the vibe.
Yes, exactly. When in doubt, sit quietly. We, however, cannot do that because we have to keep talking about the news this week, including a meeting between President Trump and Italy's President Sergio Mattarella. Not mozzarella, Mattarella. He visited the White House this week, and he and President Trump had a news conference after that meeting. Here's part of what the president said about pulling American military support for Kurdish fighters in northern Syria.
The Kurds know how to fight. And as I said, they're not angels. They're not angels. If you take a look, you have to go back and take a look. But they fought with us. We paid a lot of money for them to fight with us, and that's okay. They did well when they fought with us. They didn't do so well when they didn't fight with us.
President Trump also called the PKK, which is a Kurdish political group, probably a greater terrorist threat than ISIS. The Turkish government views the PKK as a direct terrorist threat to the reign to rule of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. During the press conference, he also lashed out at Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who has long been one of the president's biggest allies, but has criticized him, Jeff, over the decision to pull troops out of Syria. So this seems to be building a couple fault lines. One, with perhaps the national security establishment, mm-hmm. and two, with congressional Republicans who tend to be very much aligned with the president, except for now when they're like, whoa, 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 wait, this doesn't make any sense.
In a dramatic way. And the Lindsey Graham example is a perfectly good one because Lindsey Graham and the president have been so aligned on so many things, to the chagrin of some people who were friends of John McCain, with whom Lindsey Graham was also a very close confidant. But in this case, Senator Graham has been just brutal in his criticism of President Trump's decision. He has said that President Trump would have to take ownership of it if ISIS reemerges. And there's been a lot of distance between those two. And that came out in that press conference that you just referenced, because President Trump obviously showing some frustration with that criticism from somebody who is normally a supporter.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Eugene, with regard to that criticism, this is a very blithe question, but what difference does it make? I mean, there have been Republicans who've criticized the president before who either are no longer in Congress right now or who have leveled their criticism, and that was kind of it. Is there any sign that this criticism of this policy agenda? This piece of foreign policy could lead to any actual tangible pushback, or is it kind of too soon to know?
Pushback towards the president from...
In terms of resolutions or trying to curtail his foreign policy or, you know, withholding funds from certain initiatives that he wants to get forward. I mean, it's one thing to say, don't do that, Mr. President, but Congress has the power to make the president not do something.
Well, some folks that I've been speaking to close to the campaign said that the president is primarily concerned with pleasing the base. Foreign policy is not an issue that they overwhelmingly have prioritized in terms of their support for Trump. And what they have prioritized related to it is trying to keep Trump accountable in terms of his campaign promise to bring troops home. There isn't any real fear that this could like move him significantly unless there is some change among support from those people who've backed him since, I guess, day one.
Now, Yamiche, the same day as that meeting with Italy's president, President Trump met with congressional leaders at the White House to talk about Syria. This was that picture that kind of made its way around the web, partly because President Trump tweeted it out, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it her wallpaper picture on her Twitter
wallpaper.
Profile. Yeah, so she kind of is re-trolling him back. She says that the president had what she described as a meltdown at that meeting. She walked out after he called her a third-grade or third-rate politician, depending on which account you read. Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy was at the meeting and criticized the Democrats for walking out. Yamiche, the president has had contentious meetings with Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer before. This one seemed qualitatively different because in that picture, you can see people around the president, including the relatively new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just kind of looking down, wishing that a trap door would open underneath them and get them the hell out of that meeting. It felt like a different kind of a confrontation.
It was absolutely a different type of confrontation. And what you saw was Speaker Nancy Pelosi stand up in a room where she was, it seemed to be almost the only woman or one of the few women in the room, and say, "You're not going to speak to me like this. I'm actually going to walk out." So what you have was Nancy Pelosi also saying that she was in that moment, or close to that moment, saying all roads lead back to Putin and that you are essentially being pushed around by the president of Russia. So you see in Nancy Pelosi someone who's saying and really categorizing herself as someone who's going to stand up and be the face of the Democratic Party's really resistance to President Trump. And then you have President Trump and Republicans sort of saying, you know what, she's someone who's out, who's unhinged, who is not respecting the president. So you had both sides really trading partisan attacks. But this was something that was just completely, completely different.
So then, Jeff, if both sides were trading partisan attacks, is this a stalemate? Was this just one of those moments where, you know, they kind of stood on the playground and said, "You're a poopy head. No, you're a poopy head. I'm leaving." And they walk away and that's it and nothing comes of this. Was there more to this meeting that needed to happen, or was this just they sniped and walked away and that was it?
Well, the purpose of the meeting was to discuss Syria policy. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to be done for sure. And I think that both Democrats and Republicans are interested in the outcome of that. But that relationship is certainly at a critical spot, the one between the president and the speaker. There was a time when President Trump, despite using pejorative names about lots of other people who were opponents of his, would nonetheless treat Speaker Pelosi with quite a bit of respect, verbally, publicly, on Twitter, etc. That has changed, and that's a notable shift.
And they didn't speak about impeachment, but we have to remember also that that was the elephant in the room.
For sure.
And also the House had just voted overwhelmingly, mm-hmm. about 354 lawmakers, including Republicans, sent a message to the president that they were condemning his withdrawal of troops from Syria. So the president was dealing with a whole lot, and that also kind of tells us about the president's state of mind, and mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi state of mind while she was walking into that meeting.
Well, there's also just one last thing on mm-hmm. that. That's also the other sort of background to what we're talking about with regard to Lindsey Graham and other mm-hmm. Republicans who are criticizing him over Syria. These are Republicans who he will need if an impeachment vote happens in the House and ends up in a trial in the Senate.
Well, there was the back and forth between Republicans and Democrats this week. There was also quite a bit of back and forth between Democratic presidential candidates. They debated this week in Ohio, and we'll talk about that when we continue with Jeff Mason of Reuters, Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour, and Eugene Scott of the Washington Post. You know what would help calm me down right now?
Coffee.
No, calm me down, Jeff.
Well, you said you didn't have any.
I said I didn't have. I said I had caffeine. I'm not a coffee. Eugene, you know what would help calm me down? I'm going to ask you.
What would help you?
How about a little Taylor Swift?
Okay.
Because she performed over at NPR this week. She did a Tiny Desk concert, performed a few of her stripped-down versions of her hits this week. This is her performing The Man from her Tiny Desk concert. We're going to just relax to a little Taylor Swift for a second.
A little Taylor.
Catch our breath, and then get back to the roundup in just a minute. Stay close. All my good ideas and power moves. Big toast to me, oh, let the players play. I'd be just like Leo in Saint-Tropez. I'm so sick of running as fast as I can, wondering if I'd get there quicker if I was a man. And I'm so sick of them coming at me again. Back now to the roundup with Eugene Scott, Jeff Mason, and Yamiche Alcindor. Still time to get to some of your questions and thoughts. 1A at WAMU.org. Let's talk about the Democratic race for the nomination in 2020. 12 candidates took to the stage this week for the fourth primary debate in Ohio, which was on CNN. Eugene, I'm wondering what this debate showed us about the Democratic field. The tone seemed to be a little different than previous debates. The focus of the questions, of course, began with the impeachment inquiry and Joe Biden's connection to that. But did this get us any closer to kind of figuring out who Democrats are going to pick next year?
I think what we know is that Democratic candidates right now are focused on Elizabeth Warren. That's what I think was the main takeaway from that debate. And when I think about people like Julian Castro and even Pete Buttigieg, who was far more aggressive in this debate than he's been in the past, see her as the front runner and definitely are trying to attack her ideas and claim that she could possibly be moving the party to left and left of where most voters want to be, despite what polls are currently saying.
Yeah, Yamiche, there's this kind of, it's interesting, there's the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders versus Joe Biden kind of debate as to whether the party, it's almost like covering the San Francisco, you know, Board of Supervisors. Like, are you like center left or left left, basically? And there was this exchange between Biden and Warren. I mean, there were several during the debate, but here's just one of them.
Okay. I agreed with the great job she did, and I went on the floor and got you votes. I got votes for that bill. I convinced people to vote for it. So let's get those things straight, too.
Senator Warren, do you want to respond?
I am deeply grateful to President Obama, who fought so hard to make sure that agency was passed into law. And I am deeply grateful to every single person who fought for it and who helped pass it into law. But understand,
you did a hell of a job of your job.
Thank you.
So a little bit of shade thrown there between Joe Biden
Such
and Elizabeth.
Shade.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure where that ends up. I mean, I understand the dichotomy between more centrist Democrats and more progressive Democrats. That seems to be the overarching narrative. Is this a microcosm of that, or is this something else?
I think there are two things going on. First, Elizabeth Warren is putting on display her skills as an orator and her skills as a debater. All the Democratic candidates and all the Democratic voters that I've been talking to, they're all wondering, how is this person, whoever we nominate, going to talk to President Trump when they're on stage? And you got a taste of that from Elizabeth Warren. She was quick on her feet to say, hey, actually, Obama was the one who got that done, but she didn't have to say it so bluntly. The second thing is you have Joe Biden really also having to praise Elizabeth Warren for her work. But then you have him kind of adding and really, I think, in some ways mimicking what the other candidates were doing, which is in some ways problematic for him because he's supposed to be seen as the front runner. But there was Yang, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Tulsi Gabbard, and Kamala Harris all piling up on Elizabeth Warren, and he really didn't have to do that. He could have done what Bernie Sanders did, which was not say anything and almost seem as though he was above all this. But he wanted to, later on in the debate, say that she had vague health care policies. So in this moment, I think you see, yes, it was flashy and it was an interesting, I think, exchange. But I think it's really more about their individual issues and their individual skills than them versus each other.
Well, and Jeff, you know, the news cycle was so heavily focused on impeachment that this was kind of the candidate's chance to reset, to get get people's eyes back on them to kind of recapture their attention. Viewership was down from the third debate to the fourth. We had a conversation with DNC Chair Tom Perez this week on Wednesday, the day after the debate. We'll tweet a link to that out now. You can follow us on Twitter at 1A. I wonder if there's any sign that anything did shift. Granted, this whole impeachment narrative keeps chugging along, but I'm not sure who did move the needle this week.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, it is still early, as much as it doesn't seem like it is. It's October. The first caucus, the Iowa caucus, and primaries aren't until February. So there's a lot of time for things to shift. Certainly, I agree with what both Eugene and Yamiche have said. Elizabeth Warren is at the focus right now, but those other candidates who are showing their scrappiness, trying to take her on more so than taking on Joe Biden, still have some room to move.
There was some movement, though, Eugene, a little, for Bernie Sanders, at least. First of all, he was on the debate stage, had a heart attack. He appeared in good spirits, thanked people for, you know, their well wishes and so forth. Also, there was reporting that he, you know, was going to get some key endorsements this week, including from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman congresswoman, very progressive congresswoman from New York. What does that mean for his campaign, these endorsements?
Well, these young lawmakers are largely viewed by some people as the future of the party. And this is a candidate who needs more support from people of color, needs more support specifically from some people of color, which is what I just said.
Right.
But he needs to know that there are people that still believe in him, that he can move forward despite what he is currently facing health-wise. He needs people who don't view him as some like a relic of like this past election. There's a lot of emphasis on whether or not he has the vitality to move forward, if they need a new voice, if they need a younger voice.
And he attracted a lot of young supporters in 2016.
He did. He really did. And so to know that they are going with him and not some of the younger candidates that are campaigning, I think is helpful for his campaign. But for many people, it wasn't incredibly surprising. I mean, this is someone who has had a relationship, shared political ideology with AOC for a while. And I think this just confirms this.
It is interesting, though, that after this heart attack with people questioning kind of, can Bernie go on, he now has this fresh thing that he can talk about and really turn a corner from the news about his heart attack. The other thing to note is I spoke to Jeff Weaver, a longtime advisor of Bernie Sanders, and that person told me, and he told me, these are the young, really new leaders of the progressive movement, and they're choosing Bernie Sanders. That's going to be kind of their theme, and that's going to be what they want to tell people on Saturday when he has this big rally in Queens. And I think it's going to be a very big rally. People in New York have liked Bernie Sanders, so this is going to be, I think, an interesting way to see how he turns this corner.
With regards to the Joe Biden controversy, Jeff, there was an interview that Hunter Biden gave to ABC News this week in which he defended his involvement with Burisma. That's that Ukrainian natural gas company that's been the subject of so much controversy. Here is part of what Hunter Biden said.
Just a little bit in your gut, like, maybe this isn't a good idea to go and sit on the board of this Ukrainian company.
I said to you, in retrospect, I wish
right,
that my
the
judgment.
Time, you never thought this might not look right.
You know what? I'm a human. You know what? Did I make a mistake? Well, maybe in the grand scheme of things, yeah. But did I make a mistake based upon some unethical lapse? Absolutely not.
That was Hunter Biden speaking to AMC's A.B. Robach in an interview this week. Jeff, does that move the needle? Did it change anything?
Well, it got him out there, and that gave the Biden campaign, I guess, an opportunity to say, look, this is what happened. This is our response to that. This is Hunter's response to that. I think the two headlines that came out of that interview were essentially that he said he used poor judgment but did nothing wrong. And that's, you know, this has not been a great story for the Biden campaign, despite the fact that it has led to this impeachment or has been part of the impeachment inquiry into the sitting president. It's still not been a great look for the front runner or almost front runner of the Democratic campaign. So this was their chance to at least address it. Whether or not it ends up being enough is still to be seen.
With regards to who was on stage this week in Ohio, Sharon in Florida emailed, shame on the DNC for not including nine-term Congressman Tim Ryan on the debate stage. Sadly, missing from the Democratic debate in Ohio this week was the best candidate to speak to many issues, including loss of jobs and industries in his Ohio district. I think, Eugene, he wasn't there because he didn't poll high enough. He didn't get enough fundraising. But I do take Sharon's point in terms of speaking to some of the workforce issues that affect folks in the Midwest and Ohio and elsewhere. Some of the candidates did speak to that, Andrew Yang, Amy Klobuchar, and there's still that open question as to who's the best person to appeal to Midwestern voters, some of whom are Democrats or vote Democratic, but walked away from the Democratic Party in 2016.
I think Buttigieg and Klobuchar tried really hard to communicate that they could speak for Midwesterners and those who don't want to see the party move too far left, perhaps even winning some voters who were attracted to Trump the last time, but maybe looking for another option. I'm no spokesperson for the DNC debates, but what they would likely say is Tim Ryan isn't on stage because the people haven't chosen Tim Ryan in terms of how much support he has gotten, which isn't significant, and how much money he has attracted, which has kept him off the stage.
Also, the important thing that I think about is the fact that so many Democratic voters told me, wait, why are there more candidates this time around? And that was, of course, because Tom Steyer was the billionaire. Tom Steyer, it was his first debate. So there's really an eagerness and a wanting for people to have this whittled down. So I think what the DNC is trying to at least do, or what they say they're trying to do, is give voters what they want, which is a smaller field so they can really focus on who they want to vote for. I was talking to a woman, a source in Florida, my mom, and she told me, wait, they're not down to three or four yet. Right. And it was a window into the fact that people are like, okay, but really, who is going to be running?
Speaking of workforce and labor stories, there was a lot of labor news this week from the Great Lakes region. 25,000 unionized teachers in Chicago went on strike yesterday. They're demanding better pay and benefits and smaller class sizes. In Michigan, a month-long strike by GM workers might be ending. The United Auto Workers and General Motors have reached a tentative deal. It would raise wages and create career pathways for temporary workers. It would not, however, save a plant in Lordstown, Ohio, from being closed. Yesterday, we spoke with a GM worker named Sean Crawford. We met him during our Project 1A Across America. He told us that most picketers have money saved up and want a good contract more than they want to just go back to work. Crawford says he's not sure if he will sign the deal. It needs support of thousands of auto workers to move forward. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Let's talk immigration right quick, because President Trump broke some news on Twitter again last Friday evening. He announced that the acting director of the Department of Homeland Security, Kevin McAleenan, was resigning. McAleenan had been on the job for 6 months during a very fraught time in immigration policy and at the border. Jeff, this is another resignation of one of the president's top officials. But what about McAleenan? Did he make a lasting legacy or a lasting impact at DHS?
It's hard, I think, to make a lasting legacy in a six-month period. I think he's sort of in line with a lot of the others who have served the president on the issue of immigration. A lot of immigration policy really is being run out of the White House by Stephen Miller. And it sounds like the president's going to try to find somebody to go back there and keep working on his priorities, which are to get the wall built and to reduce the number of people illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexican border.
Eugene, one more immigration story before we wind down. President Trump, for the second time, vetoed legislation from Congress that would have ended the declared state of emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border. Why are the president and Congress at odds over this? Where does that stand now?
Well, I think what the president has done is consistently argued what he launched his campaign based on, that there's an emergency at the border because he believes that murderers and criminals and other individuals are coming into the U.S. to harm Americans, and that policy and funding should reflect that. And Congress just doesn't consistently support that, especially the House, where the Democrats are in control. And they've been pushing back on this idea, preventing the president from moving forward with his projects. And there's just no wiggle room on that.
Let me back up to our discussion about the 2020 candidates. We talked about Bernie Sanders and his polling. JL tweeted, "That is a 100% wrong statement that Bernie needs to poll better with people of color. Look at the poll numbers. Warren polls horribly against people of color." Well, I'm looking at a Reuters poll from August that shows that Joe Biden polls ahead with voters of color. Bernie Sanders polls behind him significantly, well outside the margin of error. Elizabeth Warren polls behind Senator Sanders. So I hear where you're coming from, JL, but, you know, second place is the first loser. So to say, Amish, that he's polling well with people of color, yeah, but if people of color turn out to be a significant voting bloc in 2020, or that makes a difference.
A couple of weeks ago, I was in South Carolina talking to black voters, which is a critically important state to win if you want to win black voters, because in that state, the majority of Democratic primary voters are black, which is not the case in other states. And people told me over and over again that they preferred Joe Biden. And one of the reasons they did that was because of that kind of shine that he gets from being President Obama's vice president. A lot of the things that he's been having to weather, gaffes and maybe the scandal on Ukraine, people told me, well, if he was good enough for Obama, then I think he's good enough for me. And that's something that Joe Biden is going to continue to hammer on. Now, Bernie Sanders has really tried. He's made some real strides since 2016, but he has a ways to go.
Yeah. I was going to say, when I made the statement that just got pushed back on, I didn't imply that Bernie was doing worse than Elizabeth Warren with people of color. The data doesn't support that. But the data does support that he's not doing well with the majority of people of color, especially when compared to Joe Biden. And he has to improve with that.
You know, Washington has a lot to stress about right now, as we have just spent the hour discussing. But D.C. sports fans have a lot to celebrate. For one, the Washington Mystics won their first WNBA championship last week. They beat the Connecticut Sun. For another thing, the Washington Nationals beat the St. Louis Cardinals in a four-game sweep. They are going to the World Series. D.C. has not been represented in the World Series since our team was the Senators back in 1933. The Nationals will face either the Yankees or the Astros for the championship, and Game 5 of that seven-game series is tonight in New York. The Astros lead 3-1, one more win, and they're going to the World Series. Eugene Scott of the Washington Post, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour, thanks, Yamiche.
Thanks so much.
And Jeff Mason of Reuters. Jeff, enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, Joshua.
Our technical team includes Jake Cherry, our lead audio engineer, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Go sit quietly this weekend. This is 1A.